Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin, and thanks for joining us. The annual Kids Count data book on children's well-being is out, ranking Kentucky 37th in the nation for the overall well-being of its children. Where were we last year? 37th. We did improve in some areas, but we slipped in others. The data book comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation and Kentucky Youth Advocates. And joining us to look more closely at one particular area of concern, child care, is Kentucky Youth Advocates Executive Director Terry Brooks. Welcome back to Eastern Standard, Terry.
Tom, thanks so much. We appreciate you spotlighting Kentucky's kids always.
So overall, Kentucky improved in 11 of these 16 indicators, did worse in 3 of them, and stayed the same in 1. Today, we're looking at one of those categories, child care. What's happening there?
The one that I would spotlight is the percentage of children who are in quality preschool experiences. And I do that because there's another very interesting correlate in where we're getting worse, which is in fourth grade reading levels. And let me try to paint this picture without getting too far in the weeds. For several years, that fourth grade reading proficiency showed improvement. We were certainly not where we want it to be, 60, 65% of kids not meeting minimal standards, but we were improving. This is the first time we have declined. And if you go back in time, the first year where we declined in the percentage of children who were in preschool experience would have made them fourth graders this past year. So what I'm trying to describe is that early childhood participation has consequences. I think that sometimes folks still see early childhood, universal pre-K, kindergarten as kind of icing on the cake. That's cute. That's nice. But what we know is that experience forms the very foundation for academic achievement in K-12. So what we saw this year is sort of reaping the harvest. 4 or 5 years ago, that percentage of kids in early childhood started to decline. And as we track as those kids get older, we now see a consequence, which is they are not as good at reading as their counterparts were 3 or 4 years ago. So in terms of connecting dots, I think those two data points are so closely linked. They also, frankly, offer both an opportunity and a warning because it means that we as a state had better get serious about improving early childhood experiences, or that academic downturn for the K-12 community just might continue.
Well, we have a lot of ground to cover, but there's a quick question I'd like to ask you about fourth grade reading. It's a pivotal year. Is that correct?
Absolutely. It is a real forecast on whether children will graduate, how they're going to do post-secondary. The old cliche, unfortunately, it's not a cliche. It's true. But folks who design and plan prisons literally look at fourth grade reading levels and project where the criminal justice system is headed based on that. So when we think about fourth grade reading, it's not a blip on the radar. It's the canary in the coal mine. And you just can't look at that and go, well, those kids will hopefully catch up. I mean, yes, we hope they catch up. But the real message that I would want your listeners and Kentucky leaders to take away is we have got to get serious about early childhood investment, or the ripple effect going upstream is going to touch fourth grade reading and eighth grade math and high school graduation, readiness to enter the workforce. And so that's not hyperbole, that's reality.
Okay, well, we're going to be talking about child care, an enormous issue, as you say, in just a moment, when we turn to Health and Family Services Secretary Eric Friedlander for more on Kentucky's child care situation. Could you expand on it just a little bit for us? What are our specific needs in that area?
Well, I think there's, and again, Secretary Friedlander is a is just a champion for Kentucky's children. And I think that he and his staff have done a remarkable job navigating tough, tough waters on childcare during the pandemic. So I just need to say that. Coming out of the pandemic, one of the issues, and it may be the key door opener, is we have got to address workforce within the child care community. I think that child care centers would tell you that they simply have not figured out how to staff at an adequate level. And so it's a catch-22. We have families who have CCAP support. They could actually get their children in a high-quality child care center, but the child care centers can't accept more children because they don't have staff. And we know that working at a child care center is tough. It's intense. It doesn't come close to paying an adequate wage. So one of the things that both the state administration, Secretary Friedlander and his staff, child care champions, folks who are running child care centers across the Commonwealth, we're trying to all think creatively about how to bolster the workforce. Can we invent career ladders? Are there ways to have differentiated pay? How do we make that profession, that arena, attractive? And I certainly would defer to the secretary on that. But I think the voices that I hear from the ground would say that unless and until we solve the workforce problem, then we really have a limit to how many children can take advantage of good child care, which leads to the next problem, that if kids can't take advantage of it, mom and dad are going to find it difficult to go back to work. So I think we've made progress as a state around quality issues. I think there are good quality standards in place. I think we have improved accessibility because of supports through, for instance, expanded CCAP funds. What we have not solved is how to create a workplace that can be fully staffed so all the kids who are eligible, all the families who need child care, can find a place to enroll their children.
All right, that's Kentucky Youth Advocates Executive Director Terry Brooks. We thank you so much, Terry, and we'll be talking to you again soon.
Tom, thanks so much.
If there is a short list of serious obstacles to restoring the economy from the downtime of the pandemic, the matter of child care would be near or at the top. Lack of child care is now the third most reported reason for not working, barely eclipsed by pandemic-related layoffs and furloughs due to reduced business. How does this look in Kentucky? To find out, we're turning to Eric Friedlander, Secretary of the Cabinet for Health and Family Services in Frankfort. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Friedlander.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to talk with you today.
So child care in America was a huge problem before the pandemic set in. And according to research that we've seen from the University of South Carolina, about 360,000 child care jobs simply vanished between February and April of last year because of the pandemic and the lockdowns. Is that national number reflected in Kentucky?
Somewhat. At the beginning of the pandemic, there was an anticipation that we could lose up to 20 to 30% of our child care capacity. We ended up losing more like a little under 10%. Mm-hmm. Which is still significant because there wasn't enough child care to begin with. And so losing any capacity was troubling and is troubling. And so that's been a challenge. You know, the one thing that I hope we all learn, because child care payment and support resides within the Cabinet for Health and Family Services, I hope we learned how important child care is to overall employment. You make a great point. There are several challenges around folks getting back to work, and child care is a huge one.
So I would say that it's absolutely interwoven, the mm-hmm. child care industry and the overall economy are hand in hand.
Yes.
Has the situation improved at all, or has it gotten worse?
Oh, the situation has definitely improved. There's been a great deal of funding that's come down to the state. to help support child care providers, and we have tried to support as best we can. We actually had a number of small family child care, which is like 3 to 5 kids. And so we didn't have enough of that in Kentucky, and we've been able to support an entrepreneurial style program that is really, we may end up at the end of the pandemic with more of those small child care providers than we had when we went into it.
Is the problem especially acute in any particular area of the state, or is it pretty much as difficult in Ashland as it is in Paducah?
No, there are child care deserts across the state, often related to difficulty of travel, poverty, those things that are challenges in different areas in Kentucky. So there are child care deserts in the state, just like food deserts and grocery deserts. They exist in different pockets across the Commonwealth.
Well, we connected child care to economy. Mm-hmm. It's also connected, I think, to well-being. The latest Kids Count data book, for example, from Kentucky Youth Advocates, shows us that more than 1 in 4, 26% of Kentucky adults living in households with children felt down, depressed, or even hopeless in 2020, with only slight improvement by March of 2021. And I know it's asking you to speculate here, but would you say that at least some of this relates to feeling trapped at home and unable to get out and work to meet expenses?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about that. The isolation that we all went through, and again, it was isolation that saved lives, has been a challenge. We've never as a community, I may be getting off child care a little bit, but we've never as a community, as a world, been through something like this, you know, since what, 1918? Mm-hmm. So the impacts of this from a behavioral health, as you talk about depression, we know we're going to see coming out of this, probably 6 months out, how much we all need to be in support of each other, to be understanding, and make sure that we get behavioral health services to folks. And making sure we have child care that exists and that people can access is, I think, an important component of that.
We hear that nationally, finding child care for infants and children with disabilities is especially difficult. Is that true in Kentucky as well?
That is absolutely true in Kentucky as well. I used to be over a place called the Commission for Children with Special Healthcare Needs, and finding child care for children with disabilities was always a challenge. Part of what we are going to use some of the federal relief funds for will be a partnership with child care and with schools who often deal with children with disabilities to try to increase access in particular for children with disabilities. And as you say, that infant toddler care is critical and requires a greater deal of expertise, a greater deal of staffing. And that's the challenge moving now, is making sure that there's adequate staff at these centers. It is one of the challenges, maybe even more than funding at this point, that they're facing, is trying to get employees right back into the centers.
Well, here comes the old magic wand question. But if you had one, what would you make happen to spur growth in child care options for working parents to a point even beyond where it was pre-pandemic, which was not great? But where do we need to be, and what can we do to get there?
So with the funding that we're receiving, we are going to support additional centers in these child care deserts. There's going to be a $100,000 matching grant for somebody that wants to open a big center in those areas. We're also providing a matching grant for employers who want to start child care centers, as well as I already addressed kind of the entrepreneurial side of it. We need to support child care workers, and we want to do that and are planning on doing that with funding to get the scholarships so that they can get the early childhood certification program, so that we can get folks on a career pathway, that they can see that there's a career pathway within child care. So supporting that. And then lastly, we're one of the lowest paid for child care. It's low cost in Kentucky, but you know, that's good news and bad news. The good news is low cost, but the bad news is we need to increase those rates for providers, and we need to provide state support and maximize the federal support so that we can make sure we're compensating folks for providing this critical care appropriately.
And that funding that you referenced, is that from the CARES Act?
It is. It's from the CARES Act. It's from the American Recovery Act. There are several kind of funding sources that are coming down to Kentucky, and we are going to try to use them as wisely as possible to make sure that we have good quality, available childcare across the Commonwealth.
All right, that's Eric Friedlander, Secretary of the Kentucky Cabinet for Health and Family Services in Frankfort. We thank you so much, Secretary Friedlander.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity to address this important issue. Thank you.
Bills going before the 2022 legislative session in Frankfort would bar classroom conversations about systemic racism, critical race theory, and white privilege, topics viewed by legislation sponsors as divisive or indoctrination of children. School districts, meantime, have been working to rectify the root causes of racial disparities in student outcomes and make history curriculum more accurate and inclusive. And all of this comes at a time when new census stats find unprecedented multiracial growth in the U.S. population, including a decline in the nation's white population for the first time in history. So what is critical race theory? UK historian Gerald Smith is here for another chapter in his series on racial justice and equality, and his guest is Julian Vasquez Heilig, Dean of the College of Education at UK and Education Chair for the Kentucky NAACP.
Dean Vasquez Heilig is an award-winning leader, teacher, and researcher, and a dynamic voice of equity in education in the United States and around the world. He has an extensive publication record and has been honored with more than 30 teaching, research, and service recognition awards. Dean Heilig received his PhD in Educational Administration and Policy Analysis and a master's degree in sociology from Stanford University. He also earned a master's in higher education and a bachelor's degree in history and psychology from the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. Dean Heilig, welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to share with listeners your research and knowledge and complete understanding of this very hotly debated academic concept on critical race theory. So I'd like to begin our conversation with you providing us with a definition of CRT.
Well, first of all, let me tell you, Dr. Gerald Smith, it's so good to talk with you again, and it's great to join your show today. So critical race theory, you know, what's happened is that this has become a catch-all phrase in the popular discourse. But critical race theory is actually something very specific. It comes from legal scholarship. You know, it's decades old now at this point. But legal scholars and civil rights scholars and activists, they wanted to understand specifically how U.S. law functioned in terms of race. And at the time, they talked about how race and later gender and other historically marginalized communities, how the law was constructed in very specific ways to create disparate impacts for people of color. So oftentimes we talk about racism as being specific to the individual level. But what critical race theory says is that there are subtle social constructs and institutional dynamics that are in play that create impacts on historically marginalized communities. And so essentially what it says is that when we talk about the law, when we talk about school finance, when we talk about the construction of curriculum, that race has become a factor in those areas.
So how did critical race theory become such a controversial issue?
That's a great question. I think after George Floyd, there was really a watershed moment, really a moment where the United States came to grip with the fact that there's disparate approaches to policing. There's disparate experiences that people of color and other historically marginalized communities have in the criminal justice system. And there was this national reawakening about what this country should do about that unfairness. I think what's unfortunate is that the response to that awakening in some sectors has been that we don't want to talk about race. We don't want our curriculum to talk about race. We don't think that race is a factor and that it's structural or subtle impacts on historically marginalized communities. In fact, we should ban those conversations. We should cancel those conversations. And, I, you know, there's an old quote, I think it was Madison, who talked about there should be more free speech, not less free speech, on the controversial topics of the day. And so I think education, whether it be K-12 or higher education, is that place. Education really is the compass of our democracy. And so for our democracy to move forward, we need to have these difficult conversations about race and gender and other issues that relate to historically marginalized communities. And education is the place where that should take place.
So let me ask you this. Is there a difference between critical race theory and culturally relevant teaching?
Well, that's a good question. You know, what's interesting is that as I began the conversation, critical race theory has become this sort of catch-all for any conversations that we want to have race. But critical race theory is something very specific. It's about structural impacts of race in society, specifically the law. Culturally relevant schooling is how do we ensure that students of color or immigrant students, how they experience their ancestors, for example, in social studies and social studies standards, how do we create a space for students so that they are able to see themselves in the curriculum and experience their histories of their ancestors and of their communities in the work that occurs. So ethnic studies is a part of that conversation. You saw Texas, for example, last year passed the first African-American history and course. And the year before that, they passed a Latinx studies curriculum. And those came from districts. The Black studies curriculum came from Dallas. You saw that also in Houston, where the Latinx studies. You also see a long-running debate in Arizona about offering ethnic studies to students. This debate goes back to California in the 1980s. These are long-standing conversations. Should people of color, should women, should they be represented in curriculum? Should they be represented in schools? Should we have teachers of color? These are long-standing conversations, and if we don't think about these issues, if we don't strategize how the action around improving the curriculum and ensuring that we're diversifying the teacher workforce, then it'll continue to be an issue. So I think we're focused on curriculum. We're focused on providing greater diversity in our teacher and leader workforce. These are things that I think many folks were inspired by the events last summer with George Floyd. And before that, Sandra Bland and many other names and faces. But I think we're at a different place now where most folks are welcoming this conversation about critical race theory, because what it really is doing is we're having a conversation about our democracy and about the representation of diverse voices in that democracy, in the curriculum, et cetera.
Several years ago, you co-authored an article in the Harvard Educational Review titled "The Illusion of Inclusion, a Critical Race Theory Textual Analysis of Race and Standards." And you mentioned Texas, and of course, that article focused quite a bit on Texas. Would you mind sharing with us a little bit about that piece that you co-authored, rather, in 2012?
Yeah, here we are 10 years later talking about the exact same topic. We use specifically critical race theory as a lens to understand standards. What are standards? So each state has a set of things that they want children to learn. Now, this has been high stakes because these standards were then represented on exams, and those exams were required to graduate from high school. So the content in those standards was very high stakes for schools, for districts, for children. And so the question that we asked was, in the social studies standards that we examined and we wanted to understand, were communities of color represented? Were leaders of color represented in the social studies standards, the things that were being required by the state for students to learn? And what we found was that the history of communities of color, African-American and Latinx communities, that they were largely made optional in that curriculum. And for Asian-Americans and Native Americans, their history was essentially excluded from those social studies standards that were politically defined at the time by the Texas Board of Education. And so this was just a very specific research example saying that communities of color were purposefully excluded from the social studies standards, purposefully made optional. So that's what that paper in the Harvard Educational Review, if I can explain a, 50-page research paper to you in just a minute. That's essentially what we found.
We know that race and racism impacts all of our lives, everyone, either directly or indirectly. So how then are we going to be able to teach about race and racism if there continues to be this this debate about critical race theory?
I think educators understand their sacred responsibility to teach the history, to teach the facts, and then let students understand those facts in the learning process. I had a call from an attorney in California. Before I came to Kentucky, I served as the education chair for the California NAACP. He's a local president out in California. And he said, "Julian, why do we call it critical race theory? It should be called critical race fact." And I thought to myself, you know, that's right. I mean, for academics, we use theory in our research processes, and we test theories with hypotheses. So, for example, we did that in the Harvard Education Review and found that absence of communities of color and their history being made optional. We were testing the theory, and when we did the research, we found that that was actually the case. What we predicted what we would find with our hypothesis, that's what we found when we did the research. But I think there is a lot of critical race fact. We know the history of Jim Crow laws. We know the reasons for the Civil War. Those things are all readily apparent in history. And so I think, you know, as a college of education dean, it's our responsibility to train educators to leave politics to the side, leave cancel culture to the side, and teach from the primary source materials, teach from the facts. And it takes some bravery to do that in this climate. But I think I have all the faith in the world that educators, whether they be K-12 educators, whether they be higher education educators, they'll leave politics to the side, and they'll continue to be that very important compass of our democracy, because without educators doing that work, we may be lost.
You also serve as the Kentucky NAACP Education Chair. Could you comment on what the NAACP is doing to address this issue?
Yeah, so I think there's the stuff that's front-facing and then there's stuff that they're doing behind the scenes. And I can't really talk about all the things that the NAACP is doing behind the scenes. But, you know, it's just an honor to serve the people of this state as a co-education chair of the NAACP. But the NAACP is concerned. They're very concerned. Mm-hmm. They're very concerned. And, you know, they want to make sure that educators have the space to teach history, and that students and that educators have freedom of speech when discussing these controversial topics, slavery, the Civil War, the Civil Rights Movement, et cetera. So, you know, the NAACP is having conversations with local policymakers, with educators, listening to their membership and listening to the community at large. As you know, the NAACP is the nation's largest and oldest civil rights organization. So the organization is paying very close attention to developments across the nation, but also locally, and committed to making sure that educators and students have access to history.
Thank you very much, Dr. Julian Vasquez Haley, Dean of the University of Kentucky College of Education and Kentucky NAACP Education Chair. We appreciate and value your knowledge and research and actually clarifying to us more about critical race theory. Thank you.
Gerald Smith's series on racial justice and equality is archived under the series tab on esweku.org. Coming up after the break, May 4th, that's a day they will not soon forget at the Mountain Association in Berea. And Kentucky history, Loretta Lynn, and a British scholar's interest in American roots music. I'm Tom Martin. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is Tom Musgrave with the Kentucky Arts Council. Coming up in Central and Eastern Kentucky Arts, Paramount Arts Center in Ashland will present Kentucky's own DeMartino Oslin Jazz Tet, featuring Vince DeMartino and Miles Oslin, Friday, August 20th. This concert is part of Paramount's Jazz Alley series. Showtime is 8 p.m., doors open at 7 p.m. For more information and tickets, visit ParamountArtsCenter.com. And through August 30th, Gateway Regional Arts Center in Mount Sterling is hosting an exhibit titled The Abstract Experiment, featuring art by Josh Spencer. For more information, visit grackentucky.org. From the Kentucky Arts Council for Eastern Standard, I'm Tom Musgrave.
Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Something happened on May 4th at the offices of the Mountain Association in Berea that would send the staff into high gear as emails and phone calls came flooding in. Well, here to tell us about this is Amanda Brewington, loan specialist at the Mountain Association, formerly known as MACET. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Amanda.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So if you would, kind of give us a before and after May 4th. What happened?
Sure. So our organization, Mountain Association, we were doing PPP loans, Payroll Protection Program loans to borrowers in Eastern Kentucky. We became a lender kind of late in the game around March, mid-March, and we were doing a few loans a week, 2-3 loans a week, and we were helping people, which is our goal, and that was awesome, and we were happy about how it was going. And then on May 4th, the money that was earmarked for banks to give out PPP loans, all was used up. And so on May 5th, I received about 30 phone calls in the 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. hour of banks calling and saying, hey, I've got 5-10 loans that I was just about to finish up, and now we're out of money. Can you take them? And I was getting calls from people who were saying, hey, I was working with my bank, and now they can't do the loan. And then I was also getting folks that just were like, hey, I heard about this PPP loan. Can you help me too? And we started helping all of them. It was really great. And the phone just kept ringing.
Okay, let's back up a bit. Back when the Federal Payroll Protection Program began in April of 2020, the SBA, the Small Business Administration, was inundated, flooded with requests for funds and couldn't handle it. And that caused the first round of requests and funds to run up quickly. Many small businesses across the country were actually just left out. So along comes this opportunity, and you were even hearing from banks?
Yeah. So the money, it was in January of this year, they decided to break the money down so that some of it was earmarked for banks and some was earmarked for CDFIs like us, Community Development Financial Institutions. And once all the money was used up for the banks, all the money that was left was specifically for CDFIs to use. And the hope is we would help, you know, smaller businesses and local businesses that maybe didn't have a banking relationship. But we started getting all the calls from the banks that said, you know, we were going to help these folks and now there's no more money. Can you take them?
And you all were the only gatekeepers to this money in all of Kentucky, right?
Yeah. We were the only CDFI in the state of Kentucky doing these loans. And so we were getting calls all over the state.
Well, how did you manage this sudden incoming flood?
Well, we started putting systems in place as quickly as we could, figuring out, okay, who's going to take the calls, who's going to actually put the loans into the system, and you know, who's going to be the help in between. And it was really phenomenal that we put it together in a couple of days and, you know, got out an Excel document and just started tracking as much as we could, as easily as we could.
And who stepped up? Who qualified for these loans?
Yeah, so the folks that qualified for the loans, most of them were sole proprietors, folks that only had, you know, themselves, their only employee, maybe one or two employees, really small companies that did qualify, and a lot of them were the organizations that missed out on the money originally. And so they were calling us and saying, you know, is this for me? Is this the loan? You know, can I get this? And a lot of them, you know, maybe didn't have great access to internet or great access to their email and things like that. I had one specific loan I remember they called and they said, we're emailing it, but, you know, I wasn't getting it. And so they ended up, you know, taking pictures of documents and sending them to me via text and trying to get all the information I needed, you know, as easily as I could for them to get it to us.
Wow. And so what would you say was the amount of the average loan?
Yeah, the average loan when we were all said and done was about $15,000.
And how did this money help these small businesses? Have you heard back from people about how it helped them through?
Definitely. So we, and just to give perspective, we had done about 36 loans before early May. And when we were done at the end of May, when the money was all gone and the program ended on May 31st, we had done 409 loans.
Wow.
So it was a lot of loans. And it was folks, farmers in the area, people who had been in business for 10 years, 2 years, all over. Most of the folks that we helped, you know, that I've heard back from are just thankful. They're, you know, now able to pay themselves, pay their employees, keep their lights on, pay their rent. One woman I spoke with, she had not paid herself in 3 months because of all her business had gone down really, really much from COVID. And so she was just, you know, happy to be able to feed her family and pay her bills.
And when we talked earlier, you mentioned that farmers that you talked to had come to you kind of confused about whether they were even eligible.
They did. Yeah, there were farmers that I spoke with that, you know, they were like, you know, do I qualify? You know, maybe they file their taxes differently than a small business does. And they did. And so we had to look at different documentation and figure out how we could help them. But a lot of people that I talked to, especially farmers being a great example, but people who just thought, this isn't for me. I'm not a small business owner in the traditional sense. So this I must not qualify. But they did.
Do I understand correctly that these PPP loans are forgivable?
Yes. So that's the really amazing part, right? So they're loans, but now that all the loans have been given to folks, all have been dispersed, now after they use the funds, we can apply for forgiveness, and it'll essentially turn into a grant. So it'll be not a loan anymore, but money that they don't have to pay back.
So you're just beginning the handling of the forgiveness process.
Yes. Yeah, so we have the 409 folks that we have to reach back out to and, you know, make sure they spent the money within the rules, you know, used it for payroll, used it for expenses for the business, get that paperwork and submit it back to the government so that we can get the loan forgiven. And then they don't have a loan with us and the government pays us the money to cover the loan.
Well, Amanda, from your perspective as a loan officer with a fiduciary responsibility, and given what you know about how these funds have been put to use, would you say it was worth the investment of tax dollars?
Definitely. Definitely. I think, you know, folks always on both sides of the aisle, whatever your political stance is, folks often think, oh, you shouldn't just, you know, give people money, give it away for free. But some of these people would not be in business anymore. They would not have been able to keep their doors open, their lights on. They wouldn't be able to keep their employees. And the cost to start a new business from scratch is much more than keeping, you know, a business going for a few rough months. And so I definitely think that this is putting, especially the folks I work with, Eastern Kentucky, in a place where they're going to come out after the pandemic is gone and be able to still have these businesses and be able to impact the community positively.
That's Amanda Brewington, loan specialist at the Mountain Association in Berea. Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you.
Well, I was born to coal miner's daughter in a cabin on a hill in Butcher Holler.
What can the music of Loretta Lynn tell us about health and healthcare in Appalachian Kentucky? Stephanie Lang is here from the Kentucky Historical Society to take us to Butcher Holler, Kentucky, by way of Newcastle upon Tyne in northern England.
Brian Ward is professor in American Studies at Northumbria University in the United Kingdom and the former chair of the British Association of American Studies. He is the co-author, most recently, of A&R Pioneers, Architects of American Roots Music on Record. And he was also a Kentucky Historical Society Research Fellow, which is how I had the opportunity to meet him. So, Brian, your research focuses on, you know, broadly U.S. South, African American experience, and you have a particular interest in popular music, which I definitely think a lot of folks listening to this will also be interested in. And Kentucky certainly has a rich musical heritage, so it was only a natural fit that your new research project, focusing on Johnson County's own Loretta Lynn, brought you to Kentucky and KHS. The thing that I find interesting is your research angle for this. You use Lynn's music to examine healthcare and medical issues mm-hmm. in Eastern Kentucky in the mid-20th century. So let's start there. How did you become interested in Lynn's music and her life, and how does using music provide a unique historical perspective or lens?
Well, you know, I've been a long time fan of Loretta Lynn, and she looms so large in the story of country music. And, you know, there's many rich and diverse aspects of her career that you could look at. But I was also, as a sort of scholar, beginning to get interested in health humanities and the story of health and ill health and health management and those kinds of things in Southern history, but more particularly in Appalachian history. And I thought, well, you know, maybe go back to some of Loretta Lynn's songs, maybe go back to her multiple autobiographies and have a look at what she makes of the health conditions that she grew up in and that evolved over time. And, you know, as I started rereading Coal Miner's Daughter, I suddenly realized that it's completely saturated in references to health, ill health, to medical care, to doctors, to nurses. And, you know, that sparked my interest. Is there more to dig up there? So thanks to the Kentucky Historical Society, I was able to do some of that kind of forensic research into the story of medical provision and health in Johnson County and Eastern Kentucky and the state more generally, and actually kind of map it onto her life, in particular her memories of her life growing up in Johnson County, because obviously she moves away, but kind of she never loses that sense that her life was shaped profoundly by those experiences growing up.
And your research shows that her songs cover a broad range of health concerns in the mountains, including black lung, mental illness, blindness, birth control, and, you know, these were only a few. So which songs did you find most interesting in telling the story of healthcare in Eastern Kentucky?
Well, perhaps predictably, you know, I sort of gravitated towards The Pill, which she records in 1972. And although she doesn't actually write that song, it's something that becomes intimately connected with her and one that she certainly identified with. The people who did write it were, you know, in a publishing company that she had set up and were briefed to write songs that she would associate with. And, you know, it's recorded in 1972. It's released with a great deal of controversy in 1975. Exactly around the time that there's a slew of Supreme Court decisions around reproductive rights and around contraception, around abortion. So it's extremely controversial and timely. But what struck me was how much it reflected her own memories of growing up completely ignorant about sex and reproduction in a world where there was so little access to good health care for women in general, but certainly for prenatal, maternal, and postnatal care for women, where the technologies of contraception were either banned or secretly smuggled into these mountain communities and looked upon askance by many medical professionals and the sort of guardians of virtue and morality. But yet for, you know, real women living real lives in those places, they were screaming out for better knowledge around contraception and better access to various kinds of contraceptive devices. And so that sort of synchronicity, if you like, the sort of joining the dots between an ongoing historical effort to actually produce better understanding of reproduction and better access to contraceptive technologies in East Kentucky, in Johnson County, the way she embraced that song as something that really spoke to her, I think was really important. So, you know, that was probably the starting point.
You wine me and dine me when I was your girl. Promised if I'd be your wife, you'd show me the world. But all I've seen of this old world is a bed and a doctor bill. I'm tearing down your brooder house, 'cause now I've got the pill.
I have to say that subsequently I became completely obsessed with her songs about alcoholism, because, you know, she lived with someone who in her second autobiography in the early 2000s, Still Woman Enough, she accepts was an alcoholic, and that disease caused enormous amounts of upheaval and turmoil and some violence in her own personal life. And you can see her evolving understanding of the ravages of alcoholism through her songs and through the succession of autobiographies. So something like What's the Bottle Done to My Baby in 1970 is an absolutely heartrending account of the damage that alcoholism, alcohol dependency, can actually do on a household. And there's also a terrific song called Wouldn't It Be Great that she records three times, first in 1985, then in 2003, and then very recently in 2018, that is actually sort of dedicated to a sort of a dream that her husband will actually be able to give up the bottle. But over those three recordings, there's an increasing appreciation that it's, you know, not that simple, that alcoholism is a disease that requires proper treatment, not just a crossing of the fingers, that things will get better.
Wouldn't it be fun if you could say you love me just one time with a sober mind? Wouldn't that be fun? Now, wouldn't that be fun? Wouldn't it be great if you could love me first and let the bottle wait? Now, wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't that be great? Wouldn't it be great? Hey, hey, wouldn't that be great? Throw the old glass crutch away and watch it break.
And certainly the songs that you've mentioned definitely had an impact on popular culture. But thinking about, too, the time that she's writing some of these, it's sort of in the shadow of the war on poverty. In terms of how Kentucky was portrayed, and Lynn herself, for that matter, in the media, how do you think popular culture shaped common ideas and also misconceptions about sickness in Appalachia?
Yeah, I think that's a really important element in that, you know, that these songs simultaneously reflect and embody certain realities of the health situation, particularly for poor, rural, working class communities in the region. But at the same time, they help to establish a reputation of the place as being, you know, blighted by any number of diseases, afflictions that are usually associated with poverty and economic distress. So I think there's a kind of genuine reciprocal relationship between the way that perhaps the broader South, not just Kentucky, is stereotyped and considered to be a place of disease and infirmity and physical and mental lack, and the way in which artists actually sort of express their engagement with those issues and those problems. That's one of the reasons why it's such a great kind of source for historians. It gives you that lived experience in a way that more traditional kinds of historical documents and policy documents and statistical findings on these diseases can't always give you that kind of access to the personal lived experiences. And that's something that clearly, you know, Lynn and her audiences warm to, is that sense that, yeah, I've lived that, I've seen that. And I think that's an important element to the whole thing. Of course, one of the interesting things about the whole image of the South as being somehow blighted and by disease is that it's counteracted by another image of the South, which is a, you know, sort of Sunbelt region that's actually got a very healthy climate, apart from the swampy bits. And, you know, there are lots of health springs that people go to, like, you know, I guess Parroquette Springs in Bullitt County in Kentucky would be a good example, where actually there's something about the environment there that is health-inducing, not health-damaging. So I think there's a, you know, a sort of complexity there that you can pick up through the music, which celebrates Southern and Kentucky life, as well as actually delineating some of its more problematic and troublesome aspects.
And you mentioned rural working class experiences, and those are certainly at the heart of many of Lynn's songs. How do you think gender speaks to healthcare issues in the region?
You know, I think it's so important. It's so fundamental. I would also add that, of course, you know, Loretta Lynn is a white woman, and her experiences are those of the white rural working class, which had so much in common with the experiences of the black working class in those same areas, but were not identical. You know, the death rates and infant mortality rates for the black population in Johnson County, as across the state as a whole, were much worse. So I think, you know, gender is one of the most important dynamics, but it needs to be, you know, fused with an understanding of the class dimension and the racial dimension. But as for the specifics of the way that gender interacts with healthcare issues, it's not a coincidence that most of the major organizations and reform movements for healthcare reform in the state are led by women. And they're often directing their efforts to securing greater and better and more affordable healthcare for women in the state. So, you know, those frontier nursing service people and the Mountain Maternal Health League, and, you know, they're all led by women, and they're all overwhelmingly dedicated to trying to improve provision access for women who, you know, as part of a sort of a bigger societal issue, are often left behind in the providing of health facilities in the region. So I think it's a gendered dynamic. And Loretta Lynn, as such an exemplary and candid songwriter and performer, you know, kind of embodies that grappling with those sorts of issues.
So to sort of wind us down, a fun question for you. What is your favorite Loretta Lynn song and why?
You know, at the risk of repeating myself, it's going to be that What's the Bottle Done to My Baby? Because I think, you know, it brings a tear to my eye every time. I just think it's an immaculate piece of songwriting and performing. And, you know, I think it so beautifully encapsulates the horrible trauma of being a carer and a loved one for someone who suffers from an addiction. And I think, you know, there are screeds and screeds of medical reports that don't get to that personal dimension of that issue in anywhere near such depth. And I think for that reason, I'd choose that one.
Well, Brian, it's been great talking to you today, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners are now going back through and thinking about some of their favorite Loretta Lynn songs. So, I look forward to seeing where this research takes you.
Thanks ever so much, and take care, everyone.
Stephanie Lang interviews are presented in partnership with the Kentucky Historical Society Research Fellowship Program. That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage is our executive producer, Wendy Barnett, producer, Neil Kesterson, producing engineer and audio editor, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard on air, online, and on mobile at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Want to suggest an interview or a topic? Drop us a line at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.